Moms and dads and children of all persuasions. Yes, indeed. Whether you like aardvarks or whether you're into abominable snowmen, we have something for you. Yes, indeed. It could be fishing. It could be something more extravagant. And I guess the what I'm trying to get to is customer came into the store today. And he'd live in Port Charlotte, and he's been coming in for years. And they just moved up north, up to another area in Florida, still on the West Coast. But he went around, he can't find any information. And he goes into the tackle stores, and they won't talk to him. They won't help him. He says, but I go to Fish and Franks, and, you know, they help us all the time. And I told him, I said, well, the reason is, the reason our store is the way it is because I traveled. And I would go to bait shops and tackle shops and say, you know, okay, I'm new around here. Is there any place I can go fishing? You know, what kind of fish you got? You know, any suggestions? And they wouldn't either have a clue, wouldn't know what to tell me, where to go, or just told me where to go, basically. Like, you know, what kind of moron was I asking them where I should go and catch fish? Now, I would have money in my pocket, money to spend. And kind of what led me to the philosophy of we don't try and sell anybody any tackle. We try to help them have fun, help them catch fish. And if they're having fun and catching fish, they're going to come in and buy more stuff. They're literally going to ask you to sell them stuff. You don't have to sell them anything. They want to buy stuff. You can make a living just if you help people.
Imagine that.
If you don't help them and they're not having fun and they're not catching fish, in what planet what universe do you really think they're going to come in and buy stuff? It doesn't make any sense. The trade-off is me and Robert and the gang at the store and RJ here helping with the radio show. We try to get you so you can go out, catch some fish, have a good time, and in exchange, we don't have to get real jobs. It'd be nice if we had better paying jobs, but other than that, Robert's there in the chair across from me, coughing in the side. He's sickly. You know, he's nightmares.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, isn't that wonderful?
Oh, yeah, it's great.
I actually had one of those. He woke up, like, terrified. And I had one of those a few months ago. Woke up just freaked out. What the heck's going on? I guess I thought I was walking into a tackle shop in another area.
Hey, I had the same thing when we went to Homestead. You know, it's like went down there with the girlfriend to try to go peacock bass fishing. Asked the guy in the shop that came recommended online with whatever 3 stars or whatever. So went in there, chatted with the guy. Asked him if he had any recommendations of canals to go look for peacocks. He said, well, people tell me they do it over here. But he didn't have a clue. Well, we went over to those canals by the raceway or whatever. They're all saltwater canals. I'm like, we pull up and I'm like, those aren't peacocks. Those are mangrove snapper. And hey, there's a snook. Oh, wait a minute. There's a manatee. Yeah, this guy sent us to a saltwater canal to go peacock bass fishing. It was nice.
Well, and it also shows the depth of knowledge that some of these people have. You know, they may know how much a particular lure costs and how many they have in inventory, but they have no idea what you're going to catch with it.
Well, this you just heard from RJ up there in the gilded chrome and gold glittered towers of power. He's our control center guy. So what he asked me is, can we do another show and include other areas of Florida? And I said, okay, well, you know, I don't mind doing it. So the point of all this is, if you're in an area and you can't get good information and there's a local radio station there, we are willing to do another program that would, wherever you are, we will include you in a fishing report each week, find out what's going on in your area. I have a lot of contacts with manufacturers, and they can put me in touch with the right people in all the different areas. So if you have a local radio station in your area that you would like to hear a fishing report on, just, you know, email me, frank@fishandfranks.com, with the radio station that, you know, would carry the fishing report, and we will do one for whatever areas you guys want us to. Help us find a radio station and, you know, that wants to carry a fishing report. And we will do reports by the station. Wherever there's a station that wants to broadcast it, we'll find out what's going on in the area and give you the updates, the fishing and all that kind of stuff that we do every week. Because, let's face it, you know, we know this area, but fish are fish. We're going to be able to help you catch fish in almost any area, anywhere in the country. Because between Robert, myself, and RJ, we fish most of the U.S., parts of Canada, Europe, Central America, and probably can get you to places beyond that. But those are the areas that we're going to try and stay U.S. and Canada for a while. But if there's a radio station you got in your area, let us know. They want to do a show, and we'll be happy to do it. And instead of trying to pick the areas, whatever radio station wants it, we'll do a report for their area. Is that all right with you?
Works great for me.
Okay. Robert, you in?
Absolutely.
All right. So anyway, getting to the fishing, just kind of weird. And there are a lot of good tackle shops out there, but there's a lot of them that just suck. You know, but I guess it's true with any kind of business.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
No matter what business you are, there's good tow trucks and bad tow trucks. There's good mechanics, bad mechanics. Good bait shops, bad bait shops. Bad bait shop. Bad. Okay. Redfish. There's a bunch of them right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been still pretty impressive out there. It's they're catching redfish and especially Bull Bay, Turtle Bay, and along the ICW, anywhere from Pine Island all the way up through Lemon Bay, I'm getting reports of redfish from 20 inches all the way up to 30 inches still. And it seems like all the bigger redfish are out along the edges of the bushes or even out on the flats a little bit. But if you move up into any creeks, no matter where it's at, east wall, west wall,
little bays, creeks, anywhere where you've got thin, narrow,
confined quarters,
a little bit of overhanging branches, and you really want about 2 feet plus of water.
Mm-hmm.
If it's real shallow in area, but there's a 2 foot or better pocket of water, you're probably going to find a bunch of little redfish in there. If it's 3 or 4 foot, it's almost guaranteed.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty wild how they're segregated, because usually this time of year, you're finding baby redfish up in the creeks and out on the flats. But right now, they're totally separated.
Yeah, and it's crazy.
Guys are catching them on a variety of stuff. The bigger redfish seem to be doing really exceptionally well on shrimp, cut ladyfish, and cut pinfish. But the little redfish up in the creeks are primarily just doing the shrimp thing. The hard part about using the shrimp for those bigger redfish out there on the flats, especially along Lemon Bay, you know, last year we had that red tide that pretty much made it void of pinfish. But the pinfish made a pretty profound comeback up in there. So a lot of guys are having a difficult time keeping some of their baits on because the pinfish in some of those areas are like little vicious piranhas lately.
If you got an area where you have a lot of pinfish and they're chewing your bait apart, catch a couple of them, cut them up, and toss them back out. Pinfish is weird. They don't seem to eat other pinfish.
No, they very seldom are beating each other up. Every now and then they'll come in and take a shot at it, but it's kind of like a buzzard on the side of the road. One gets hit, none of the other buzzards will touch it. And there's something about a pinfish where they don't seem to want to eat each other.
Yeah, so a good way of fishing for redfish in Lemon Bay right now would be catch yourself some pinfish. I'm going to say if they got to be about half the size of your palm, that's for the average person.
Yeah, that'd be about right.
Put the hook in right above the anal opening, in one side and out the other. You want to use a 3-aught, 4-aught hook, maybe even a little bigger, determining on the size of the pinfish. But I'm looking for a little bit bigger hook because I'm going in one side of the fish and out the other. That's a lot of meat there. You still have to have a point of the hook. If the hook is real tight, you're going to get a lot of bites. You're not going to get any fish. It's going to pull right through. Get us some hooks sticking out. Now, before you throw them out, Carl figured out if you trim the tail off, then trim the dorsal fin off, trim the pec fins off, and the fins on the belly. Basically, take a pair of scissors with you, and before you cast that pinfish out, put him on the hook, trim the tail, the fins, get rid of all that. Pitch him out there. Now, it makes him a very clumsy swimmer, and he's aggravated because, A, he's got a hook in his little butt. B, you've just cut all his fins off, so he's a little PO'd, so he's going to bounce around and do a lot of movement. And you get a couple ways. If I'm going to do that, I might put a split shot on the one end, but I have to use such a large split shot. I'm going to have the hook. I'm going to go about 18 inches, 2 feet down to a swivel. And then I'm going to put the line through a egg sinker, a barrel sinker. All I'm going to do is run the line through it tied to the swivel. So that sinker's sliding loose on the line. And when I cast him out, that fish is going to swim because he's hooked in the anal opening. He's going to stay upright as much as they can because you've cut all his fins off. But they're going to try and swim away from the sinker and pulling them, and they're in kind of distress. They're being pegged in one spot, and it's going to bring the redfish to your bait. You're not going to have to cast so much. Gonna leave him sit there, let him, you know, expel himself out pretty good. And when the fish come up, he can't get away that easy. Pinfish are quick. They're really fast. So this is a good way of getting them. And what Carl was finding, where the redfish were coming up mouthing the baits and not taking the bait. As soon as they'd squeeze and they'd kind of skin off some of the scales. But by removing the fins, slowed them down, made them good bait, and pinfish was awesome on redfish. I'm sure it'll work on snook and other things. But you do need a pair of scissors. Do not attempt to remove the fins with your knife. Not if you like your thumb or your other hand.
Right.
A scissors. That's tijera in Spanish, if you're listening in Spanish. I don't know what it is in German, but all I can tell you is not a knife. It's not a good practice.
No, so, and they make, you know, and we carry those poultry scissors, essentially, is what they are. They're just a good, heavy-duty pair of kitchen scissors.
Yeah.
And they're cheap, you know, and they work incredibly well for trimming up the fins on any bait fish or in a scenario with
a small bait.
Yeah, I use them to cut up pinfish or sardines, some of your softer, bonier fish. You can cut them right in half or into pieces with those scissors. So they're a pretty important tool, I think, to have on in your tackle box.
You know, I have a lineman's scissors that I take with me, and you can cut just about anything with it.
Oh, yeah.
And they're small. That. They're small and short. They were for cutting and stripping wire, you know, mm-hmm. So cut through copper. So it'll easily cut through anything a fish can present to you.
Right. That's a good idea.
Lineman scissors are nice.
Yes, they are.
Of those, but they're expensive.
Yeah, you got to steal one. And
yeah, have a buddy who's just
wait for the guy to go up the pole and grab it as he's going up.
Yeah, when he gets about 5 feet off, do a jump.
Yeah, and then run because he's got to come back down because he's got those spikes on his feet.
Yeah. So the other thing I would do with a pinfish. Now this is a little different. If I'm fishing for redfish with a pinfish, I'll take a jig head, 1/4, 3/8, 1/2 ounce, and fairly good size hook. And I'll put it right under the dorsal fin, a little bit forward of center, in one side and out the other, right by the dorsal fin. When I toss them out with that jig head, they're laying sideways on the bottom. They can't get upright. And they want to fight to get away from that. And so their head and their tail's flopping around real good. They're kicking up a lot of sand. It makes a big disturbance in the water. Now, I've never tried it when removing the fins, but it's something that you might want to do. But I would just try it, just putting the hook in one side and out the other, just under the dorsal fin, a little more forward, not back, but more towards the head, about a third of the way towards the head from center. And that flopping, beating the bottom, it's making noise, it's kicking up sand, it looks like there's a big thing going on. That will bring the redfish up to them, and I've done very well with that. But you want to use like a mission fishing that's got a big hook.
Yeah, something with a little wider gap to it.
Strike King, it's got a big gap on the hook because that bait's going to be flopping around and everything on there. And you want a big bend in that hook from the shank coming down where it bends and goes to the point. I want a good area in between there for that fish to move around on and really bang the bottom up.
Right. Well, and also by him down there trying to right himself up to be able to try to escape, which he can't. It's very difficult. But you've also skewered their body, so you're creating scent in the water. But also where you've put those two holes at, you've loosened up those scales, and with them struggling around, they're sending off little pieces of scales into the water that act as a little bit of an enhancer for reflection in the water. So you kind of get the whole cake, basically, when you put them out there. You know, it's pretty impressive.
Well, it's actually like the whole Sunday, because that technique is redfish Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, you used to do that with whitebait.
Right.
But doing it with pinfish is as or more effective, and it's really good on the redfish. Caught many species of fish with it.
I was going to say, my dumb question of the day is, do redfish normally eat pinfish?
If they could catch them.
I was going to say, I think they normally don't eat pinfish, and then the pinfish has some defenses against a bottom-mouthed fish like a redfish, you know, with his spines. So that may be why they pick them up, they mouth them, and then they let them go.
So you might be right. You might end up having to cut the fins off when you're doing it the redfish Sunday as well as when you do it the other way. Now, I've done it, hook them over the anal opening and had redfish swallow them readily.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the first year anybody ever had to cut the fins off to get the redfish to eat it. Now, it could be just a small window phenomenon, or it could be a new trend where the redfish just don't want to do it.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely that, but at the same time, when was the last time we had redfish of this size in January?
Yeah.
I can't remember. I mean, usually we're dealing with that with the pinfish feed with redfish. Usually it's like August and September are like the best 2 months to use them for the bigger redfish. So we're on a completely different time of year. We're dealing with something we've never dealt with before, so It's all completely new and different.
So if you got two guys fishing, one throw it out one way with the fins, the other one throw it out another way without the fins, see which way does better.
Right.
Kind of a pain in the butt to trim all the fins and all that if you don't have to do it. The easiest way to do it is if you got two guys, one do it one way, one do it the other.
Yeah. Well, that makes perfect sense.
See which way is working. If you don't have to cut all the fins off, rock and roll.
Or right. If you're by yourself, throw two rods out and see what happens.
I'm not big on the two rods, one person thing.
It's too hard for me to keep track of it.
I've gotten into a lot of trouble doing that, yeah. But
I end up losing more fish than what I get, or gut hooking fish, or doing whatever. Sometimes, like Mark Twain said, put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket. You know, yours is what I would have done a number of years ago and what normal people would do. But I've lost so many fish doing the multiple rod thing.
I have too.
That I'm down now more to Mark Twain, all your eggs in one basket, watch the darn basket.
No, I'm with you on that one too.
Just alternate what you're doing. If you're not catching fish, try something else.
Well, I put them out with the fins on it, fish for 10, 15 minutes. If you don't get a hit, cut the fins off, see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you get a hit, I think more to the point is if you get a hit but don't get a fish. If you don't get a hit, there might not be any fish there.
This is true.
But if you get a hit and they won't commit to it, then try and take the fence off. If you don't get a hit, you know, 15, 20 minutes. I don't understand that about pier fishermen. They go down and say, well, there's nothing biting. Well, how long were you there? Well, I was there for 5 hours and I didn't get a bite. You were there for 5 hours? Really? 30, 40 minutes and I'm going to move 20 feet down the pier if I'm at the end. And if you're fishing a pier and you want to catch snook or redfish, you go out a ways in the pier and cast back at the land. You don't go out to the, if you're looking for a redfish, you don't go to the end of the pier and cast out as far as you can. You've got a 1 in 10,000 chance of catching a redfish there. If you go 20 or 30 feet out onto the pier, and before you walk out, stop right where it meets land, where the pier meets the shore, and look along there. See, is there anything in the water? Is there an old tire there? Is there a lawn chair in the water? Is there grass? What is it that you may be able to cast to? Then you walk out on the pier and you cast back at those things. And that's where you're going to catch a redfish. Back up in that 10, 12 inches of water. That's where they're going to be. Or maybe in 18 inches of water. But walking to the end of the pier and then throwing out as far away as you can, well, you've walked as far as you could away from the redfish. Now you're going to cast as far away from the redfish as you can. Go out, go to the left or right, pitch back at the shore. That's where your snook or your redfish is going to be. As you're walking out on the pier, cast one side. You know, go out, fish back along the shore. If you don't hit anything, go about halfway out, cast one side or the other. See if there's anything there, trout, ladyfish. And if you don't get anything, move a little further out. Work the pier the way someone would in a boat. If you're in a boat and you don't catch anything for 40 minutes or half an hour, I'm moving down the shoreline a little bit. I might move 20, 30, 50, 100 feet. But I'm going to move a little bit. Maybe it's just to the next cut in the mangroves, the next little inset. Or I'm going to move to the other end of the island or just a little further down. But I'm not going to spend all day if there's no fish there. And the same thing I do on the piers when I fish piers all the time. I work the pier and I could learn more about it. Okay, you know, I was telling a guy, if you're walking out in the Elgin Pier and you've got all that seawall to your left, and then you walk as far away from that as you can and throw as far away from that as possible, you've just thrown as far away from possible from the mangrove snappers and redfish, possible sheephead. You went away from all the fish. They were back there by the seawall because the seawalls had barnacles, oysters, apartment buildings for tons of bait fish. That's what the oysters and barnacles. As they grow out, even the fish that don't want to eat the oysters and barnacles eat the stuff that lives around the oysters and barnacles because it's good shelter. It's very hard for a fish to get them when they're tucked in there. Every once in a while, they stick their dumb little head out and somebody eats them. But that's what happens when you get stupid.
Well, and Eljo Bean's kind of, you know, that corner seawall you're talking about, I've had some of my best snook nights and evenings there ever because it's a little bit of a pinch point, and the current wraps around there and sometimes eddies right there, regardless whether the tide's coming in or going out. So it's a perfect ambush point for multiple predators.
And then you've got the highway bridge piers coming down, and they're right there, well within casting distance. I feel the same way. I'll walk out onto the pier, and there's guys fishing in the other direction towards the west, throwing it out into deeper water on the river on the opposite side of where the highway bridge is. There's nothing out there.
Well, what you're doing at that point, when you cast out into open water, you're pretending you're a deer hunter standing on the edge of a field. So you're out there hunting deer, and what you've decided to do is make a stand on the edge of a big field. And you're hoping a deer is going to cross that field while you're standing there. And the same thing, when you take a bait and you throw it out in the middle of open water, you're making a stand hoping a fish is going to come by that while you happen to be there. Exactly like deer hunting on a stand on the edge of a field or whatever it would be. It's the exact same scenario. There's no reason for a deer to live in that field. But you're gambling that the deer is going to cross that area where you can get a shot at it. When you cast open water, you're gambling a fish is going to cross that open water for whatever reason. Now, I strongly urge you to think, why would a fish cross there? What reason would they have to go back and forth across that particular section of water? Is it from one food source to another? Is it just a random place? Is it open? Is there any reason for a fish to cross that bit of open water? That would be my first thought, is, okay, I'm going to throw out here and fish. And if you don't know the bottom, you're going to take random shots at it. But if you can see, okay, there's a pier down there's a pier here. If I can throw between those two, there might be a chance one fish is leaving the one pier to go to the other pier, or one dock to go to another dock, something like that.
Right.
But yeah, usually fish go from one food source or one hiding place to another.
Yeah, and a lot of times they orient some kind of structure to their path. So if you've got an oyster bar that lines up with that particular dock and current flow, that's going to better your odds of being in that open pasture area, basically, hoping that they're going to cross that section. So if you can figure it out, like on a low tide, going out there and looking around to see if you see any oyster patches. Like, I've got a really great spot there at El Jobin on the incoming tide for trout fishing, and I've caught some sheep's head off of it because there's a small oyster patch out there. And it drops off on the backside, on the upriver side of that oyster patch. And it's always done me pretty well for trout and some sheep's head.
Now, I will bet you found that because you cast it out there, sinker, hook, got snagged, brought in an oyster, and went, uh-oh, I know what this is.
Yep. Yeah, that was actually, I was still in, oh, geez, I think I was in junior high because you were actually one to teach me about oyster patches back then. And because I, dumb kid from Arizona, I knew what a cactus was, but I really didn't know what oysters were. So, you know, you were explaining to me about oysters and barnacles and the structure that they hold, and that's how I found that spot. And it's been a few years since I fished it there at El Jobin, but I fished that from, geez, the mid-'80s all the way through until the middle 2000s.
And I think you got to think like a fish. If you're a fish, unless you're an apex predator like a bull shark and you're fully grown, something is going to eat you, and something is looking to eat you actively. So are you going to be swimming around in open water by yourself, or are you going to move along structure and along the edges of things? And it's just the way the game is played. You get out into the outback there, and something's going to eat you. So most fish won't do that.
Yeah. Well, you got the two things. You've got to eat somebody, and somebody's trying to eat you.
Yes, exactly right. Even
and
better.
So you're going to go along as a fish, and you're trying to find something to eat. And the whole time you're trying to find something to eat, somebody bigger than you is come along trying to eat you. So you got two concerns in this. Eat or be eaten.
Yeah.
And the smaller you
are. It's like a really good Saturday night.
Right, right. And the smaller you are, the more places you're going to need to hide.
Right, so. Exactly.
Now, let's go down even as far as the tiny crabs, the shrimp, the little tiny bait fish that are out there. Again, eat or be eaten. So if you're that tiny that you can fit under or between oysters as they grow, what more perfect cover? You're a little crab. You just back into one. You're a fish. You swim in there and you look. And, you know, hopefully nobody sees you. You poke your little head out. Somebody eats you. But this is the kind of thing you're looking for when you're looking for bait fish and small bait. Where are they going to live where they can eat something and still maybe not be eating themselves? So the bigger fish come along that are looking to eat them. Now, a lot of these fish prefer open water because they're going to swim away from a predator. And that's what schooling fish are all about. Ladyfish, Spanish mackerel, jacks, bluefish,
all
these
of your
fish,
big schooling bait fish.
These
white
are
baits,
schooling fish.
Cigar minnows.
That are looking to eat something smaller than them, but they're in a big bunch together. And the idea behind the Big Bunch is they hope you eat their one next to them and not them.
Right.
So they use the open water to try and escape in a group by going fast and getting out of the way, and also hoping that somebody doesn't eat all of them. They're going to get a few, but not everybody.
Right. No, that makes sense.
So when you're a schooling fish, you're going to come to an oyster patch or something like that. You're going to browse for food, but then you're going to get out of there. You don't want to spend a lot of time, because if you do, something's going to notice that you're there and come in to attack you.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's just the nature of the business with all of your bigger fish. There's always going to be that food chain. But, you know, going back to the small fish part of it that a lot of people seem to get confused with is they forget that everything is born small. You know, and from the smallest microscopic shrimp and crabs that are around those spots to the smaller bait fish to the little bit bigger bait fish, it's all a big, big scale of different size fish coming through all of those areas. And it's amazing because we talk about people, well, you're only catching small trout there, or I'm catching Goliath grouper / Jewfish. Well, you're catching Jewfish there, you know, and they don't realize that Jewfish are born really, really small, so they could only be 10 inches long where you're catching them on some of those oyster patches that are sitting there using those oyster patches for camouflage, waiting for some other critter to come by so they can eat it. And it's funny how people get confused by the sizes of the fish. We're always thinking that they're always just born big.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing how fish are like with this closure. People think, well, they closed it, and in a year we've got more redfish and more snook than we ever had because it was closed for a year.
We got 30-inch snook everywhere now. Yeah. That closure did such a great job. That's a 4-year-old fish minimum.
Right.
But it's all about, you know, break it down. So one of the things I had a lot of questions about is guys were seeing dead snook in some of the freshwater ponds north of us. And the snook, they get, a lot of times we get flooding water conditions where the wind blows in real hard from the west. The water goes way up, and these fish swim. If you've lived on a freshwater lake, you know when you get a lot of rain, those fish will swim up into the trees and the grass where they can't normally feed.
Right.
New areas, you know. And it doesn't matter to them if the wind's blowing or if it's rainy, they're already wet. But they'll swim into these areas and try and figure it out. And a lot of times they get trapped in small ponds, small little canals, creeks, freshwater areas. And snook, redfish, all them can live and breed in most of Florida's lakes and rivers because of the mineral content. They might not have enough salt, but they do have enough minerals in them that it seems to work okay. They have a hard time spawning in any numbers because the eggs are designed to float in salt water, which most of them in freshwater sink, so only a small percentage of the eggs survive. But they live, breed. But a lot of our ponds here they might be an acre across or 3 acres across, but they're, a lot of them aren't much more than 4 feet deep. They might have 6 feet of water in the middle, but fresh water does not get colder than salt water. In fact, it's the other way around. Salt water can get much colder than fresh water. Fresh water can only be 33 degrees. What is it at 32 degrees?
Ice.
But because salt water doesn't freeze the way freshwater does, salt water can easily get into the 20s. I don't know exactly where salt water starts to freeze, but mostly what I find when salt water starts to freeze, it's the spray that's freezing. You get a rough area and the wind's blowing, the waves start crashing, the spray starts freezing, and then that spray builds up and forms a layer of ice on top of the salt water. But it's really hard to get salt water to freeze. So these freshwater canals, they're seeing the snook in them dead in several of the ponds. And it wasn't because they were in freshwater. It's because they were in shallow water. Whether it's fresh or salt, the water's going to get cold in those shallows. And unless that snook can maintain 50 degrees of water temperature, it's going to die. Doesn't have to be 32 or 20 or anything. It only has to get down to 46, 48 degrees. Snook's going to die. And
well,
a lot of
fish.
Those ponds. Yeah. That's why they don't have them in Georgia or the Carolinas or anywhere else. Basically, Tampa South is the normal range for snook. They've got some in very South Texas, but it's South Texas, not North Texas.
And it's not a consistent population. Every couple of years there, it gets knocked back. Here, it's every few years it gets knocked back.
Yeah,
like
we get
right now,
every
over
10 or 20 years.
Right now, over in Mosquito Lagoon, they've got a lot of snook in it. 20 years ago, there was virtually no snook in it, but 20 years ago, there was a couple good 2 years or 3 years in a row with the cold snaps that killed those fish or pushed them out into, is it the Banana River?
Yeah, made them go south.
Basically headed them south down towards Sebastian Inlet and places like that where they can actually survive in that deeper water. So that's just Mother's Nature is going to allow them to, they want to spread their population by nature, but nature's going to slow them down and put them in their place every now and then. Sometimes yeah. It's just every few years. Sometimes it's every couple decades.
Well, the reason I was going into that was the guy thought they died because it got cold and they were in freshwater.
Right.
And I said, no, it doesn't matter freshwater, saltwater. It matters can they access deep water.
Right.
If they can get down to where it's 6 foot or better, usually they'll survive. But when we had that big snook kill years ago, lazy, stupid snook died. They were too lazy to leave under the mangroves and go all the way off the flat or to a very deep hole. They had learned, you know, they could just drop out and go in these little 2 foot holes and survive quite well and then go back under the mangroves. They were only going 20, 30 feet.
Yeah.
And they didn't leave the flat entirely. That's why 80-90% of all the snook who died within 15 feet of the mangroves. Because they didn't leave the flats. All the snook that were off of the flats, they survived. Most of the canals, the fish survived. But in the very ends of the canals, and especially in Port Charlotte, you have a lot of very shallow canals. Some of those snook were trapped in shallow water at the ends of the canals, and the water got that few degrees too cold, and they died.
Yeah.
But they were fish that didn't go deep when it got cold and shallow when it gets warm. That's the way snook needs to go to survive. Like human population. You're always going to have a bunch of them that just don't get it. The power could go off for 6 months, and we have a large segment of our population right now that would starve to death with a herd of cows on one side and a field of wheat on the other because they wouldn't have any idea what to do with it.
Yeah, that's pretty sad.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but it's true. I mean, look at the pretty cows. Look at all the, that's pretty grass. It's wheat, you idiot. You can eat it. But anyway, sharks are, is this still going on, the shark inundation? We're being overrun by sharks.
I don't know about that.
Overrun, I tell you. They're coming on land. There are sharks going down 41. It's Sharknado. They're everywhere.
They seem to be pretty abundant.
Watch out for a knock on your door.
Yeah.
Land shark.
They're pretty abundant out there, really. It's pretty. I've never personally seen this number of sharks this time of year. There's always a 2 to 4 week window in the wintertime where your sandbar sharks move in close to shore along with a few black tips and a few spinner sharks, but.
But it's always a few.
Just a few. You'll fish really all day for one run or one fish. These guys are going out and catching anywhere from 1 to 5 fish with 4 to 10 runs. And it's consistent enough where just about anyone can do it. And a lot of people are doing it from shore. But they're catching
bonnet
heads.
Great day to do it right now because east wind is going to be beautiful out there.
Mm-hmm.
Wind at your back, cast out there, let it rock.
Yeah, the even weirder part is they're catching bonnet heads, too, out there from the beaches. So it's not just medium to bigger sharks, which is like 4 to 7 footers. They're catching those 2 to 3 foot bonnet heads, which is great. So even if you don't have a big shark rod,
you can go out there and still have a fun out there. Put a steel leader on it and catch some sharks.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't have to have some monster setup. Any fishing pole you own will work.
Yeah.
Just don't put that big a piece of bait on it. Four-odd hook, little 2-3-inch piece of fish, cast it out there. You'll catch a shark, I'd say 7 out of 10 times right now.
Yeah. So why do we think there's so many sharks so late into the year here?
I don't know. I mean, I've never seen it with this many sharks this time of year. I mean, working at the shop for 21 years now.
Oh, it's got to be 22 or 23.
It's something like that. It's still an impressive amount of time.
I can't remember how long you were there. How would you know if there was any sharks here a year ago?
Right.
Okay. No, but you're right, Robert. They're literally
unprecedented. It's never been like this
I'm hearing from people that have come down to visit, you know, and are walking the beaches because it's too cold to go in the water, and they're seeing sharks, which I think is pretty cool. Off of Inglewood Beach, off of Venice Beach, Manasota Key, they're actually seeing sharks going across in the water. And
We don't know why.
Yeah. Mm-mm.
It could be. Now, I've heard reports that there's gazillions of bait fish out there right now.
Well, that would be my first guess, is the food that they want is here.
But it's not like cast nettable white bait and thread fins. It's tiny ones, almost. There's from glass minnows to little 1-inch white bait and thread fins. Not like they're 4, 5, 6-inch fish, but there's gazillions of white bait, thread fins, sardines, glass minnows, but they're all in that tiny baby stage. But literally covered in water in some areas for acres.
And you would expect there to be like Spanish mackerel and ladyfish and bluefish mixed in with those, but that's not the case.
Yeah, we're not seeing the small predatory fish going after the bait fish. But we are seeing the sharks go after the bait fish.
Right. You know, and this year the mullet prices never went up, so the mullet fishermen never went out and whacked a bunch of them. So a lot of mullet made it offshore and started to come back. But they follow, you know, the sandbars and blacktips will follow those mullet back inshore. But there's still not a great number of mullet anywhere out there in the harbor where you're going, yeah, that's the reason why they're all still here.
If one idiot from the CCA or any of these other groups or FWC is listening, forget closing the trout, snook, and redfish. Just close mullet for a couple years. No commercial take on mullet, you know, and let the mullet do it. And conjunction it with the feds, because they go out to spawn. They go out past the 9 miles in many cases, and the purse seiners take them all. They don't get 10% of the school or 50 or 70. They get 99% of that school of mullet with a purse seine boat. So make it no landing of mullet on the west coast of Florida. There's not enough money in it for them to come and go anywhere else with it. Make it so you can't take it for a year on this coast. Let's see what happens. For 2 years, no mullet take. I will guarantee bigger schools of trout, redfish, snook, everything. You'll have way more fish than doing what you're doing, because you're doing the obvious thing. Oh, gee, I'm a good guy. I closed the snook and redfish. We're going to protect them. You didn't protect anything. You're not helping. You're being a social media moron is what you're being.
I'm going to go one step further with that, with the mullet. You know, you're talking about it. You know, it's going to be a year-round food source for them. But, you know, over the last basically 15 years, let's say, mullet have gotten less and less and less and less out there because of taking them during their row season. And one thing that's gotten more and more of is that rolling snotgrass, your seagrass in general, both your turtle grass and your eelgrass, has gotten less and less out there. And talking to a lot of even mullet fishermen admit that mullet are like our grazers. They're almost like our gardeners of the bottom of the harbor. They go down, they scoop up a little bit of sand, filter it out into their gizzard, and keep on moving along. Who's to say that they're not the beginning stages of the health of the harbor for all those grasses that were having issues with dying off.
Like a thatching mechanism?
Yeah.
And they also help oxygen grass and trim it down.
Oxygenate that sand so you get better rhizomes to grow healthier eelgrass and turtle grass, which will help prevent that snotgrass and algae from being such a problem, that rolling moss, whatever you want to call it, that's taking over areas and smothering out what little bit of grass we have left. Who's to say that that can't be part of the problem, too?
Well, you know, the guys were whale hunting, and that krill,
mm-hmm.
if you eat krill oil, you're a jerk. Never, ever buy krill oil. That's the food for whales and penguins and stuff. And the Russians, yes, the Russians, the nasty Russians, have figured out a way of making the krill edible. I forget what it was about the krill, but they were just god-awful. And they process them now to get the oil out, and they can sell the meat. Well, the problem is they actually thought the whales were eating too much of it. So they were promoting whale harvest, which I'm not a big fan of. In fact, I just don't think you should do it. I think you're kind of a jerk. But what happened was they found that when the whales were diving through the schools of krill, all the air and, I guess, whale poop, whatever it was actually creating more krill because it had something to do with
the nutrients in it.
The nutrients and the spawning and the whole bit was all revolving around the whales pounding through the krill. And without that, they got to be less and less krill. So they were killing whales thinking they could get more food fit or more fish to make money off of. When it turned out, without the whales, they couldn't get the krill.
There
so I'm healthy and I'm an eco person. I eat fish oil I buy at the store instead of like catching a fish and eating it, you freaking moron. One fish dead, you're healthier. Fish populations are healthier. Morons. I hate eco idiots. Yeah. I'm not overly opinionated.
No, not at all. Not at all.
But I mean, I just don't like 15 pounds of fish having to die so you can feel good that you didn't kill anything. You just ate fish oil pills.
Well, and to go back to the idea about the mullet season, this is something our listeners need to get involved in. It's not just the three of us ranting and raving that's going to make any difference.
At this point, I think it is.
Yeah, well, if you're listening, you know, this is the time to write letters, make phone calls, and start to bring this up. Put it out on social media, because I really think this is a key issue. From all the years that I've been in Florida, I've seen that less and less and less mullet. There were times that they would cover the whole surface of a bay. And now you're lucky if you see 20, 30, 40 in a school.
Well, I challenge any one of them to go out and just pull up on the west wall, anchor up, and look every direction you can. See how long it takes you to see a mullet jump.
Right.
20 years ago, it was every 2 to 5 minutes you heard or saw.
Sometimes there were multiple mullet jumping all around you.
Right.
And we've talked about this before. Everybody's complaining about there's no trout, can't find any trout, are all too small. That's because the fish that normally eat mullet are now eating trout because there's no mullet to eat.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to change the equation here, you know.
One thing affects everything.
That's right. And you've got to look at the unintended consequences. You've got to look at the chain of title like they do in real estate. You know, one thing affects something else. And I think our government leaders in fish and wildlife have been really short-sighted in this.
Well, it's hard to see very far when your head is placed firmly between your butt cheeks.
Yes, that's true.
The butt cheeks and the side act as blinders. It's really hard to get a good clear vision.
If you make enough noise, though, they'll pop their head out for a moment or two to see what it's all about. So make some noise out there about there should be a closure of mullet.
Well, the one thing is everything affects everything. Time affects this show. We wanted to get into I'm going to give you a quick breakdown. Sharks on the beaches, bass fishing, really doing well. Check out the spillways as soon as it rains for big snook and tarpon.
There's small tarpon up in the Piesemaika River. We got sheephead on the ICW, the Tom Adams Bridge, the Venice Jetties, redfish up Mat Lache, Bull Bay, Turtle Bay, the ICW, sharks all over the beaches, not in the harbor, boys and girls. We still got 2 minutes. Oh, good. I could talk slower. All right.
I think we should concentrate a little bit on those spillways, you know, of what's going to happen because we got this
Take
front,
it, Robert. You got a minute and a half.
Okay. You got this front that hit today. It rained really good last night, almost a half an inch. In
yeah, so a lot of water came down last night.
But it was a nice soft rain, so a lot of it soaked in. But now tomorrow night's rain that we might get, they're expecting up to a half an inch to an inch in some areas. The ground's already a little wet, so we actually might have some issues where rain's going to run off of all these ditches and cause some of the spillways to maybe flow a little bit heavier. So if you've got a spill dam on the saltwater side, you're probably going to have some pretty good snook and juvenile tarpon activity going on, especially up here in some of these Northport canals. And then in the freshwater canals, wherever you have a little levee or a culvert pipe, you're going to see some water flowing. And I think the bass, because they've kind of gotten a little better this past week, especially with shiners, I think you're going to see a little bit more activity hanging out around some of these spillways, getting some more oxygen in there, pushing some food over. You might see even a good crappie and bluegill bite going on. You know, all fish tend to get active right before a front comes through anyway, but you add that rain water flow mixture into it, I think it's got some pretty good potential over the next 2 to 4 days of being good fishing.
I was looking at the radar trying to figure out if anything good I could see, but I can't see what anything's coming at us. So we're just going to know it's coming. Anywhere where you have freshwater dumping into saltwater, spillways include drainage pipes, storm culverts, dams, weirs, any place like that after tomorrow night's rain is going to be on fire with snook and tarpon. Bye, boys and girls. Fish and Frank, Robert, and RJ. We're here. You're not. Where did you go? I'm leaving. Help me, NEM. I'm going away. I'm going fishing. Hook sand.